This conference is being recorded.
This is Don Hassig with Cancer Action Network, and you're listening to Loving the Earth, Pollution Free Rising. This morning, Daniel Brown from the Prairie's Edge Eco Village in Manitoba, Canada, is joining us. Good morning, Daniel.
Good morning.
I'm hoping that your weather out there is, as we're truly having, you know, less extreme winter than we had been having. We're, you know, having these way below zero nights, and I was burning firewood, you know, very, you know, much more so than what I usually burn during the average kind of winter weather around here. But it's warmed up some. We're actually having some thawing weather and some just barely freezing weather, so it's being easier on the fuel supply this winter now, recently, than what it was before. Tell me about Prairie's Edge Eco Village.
Well, we live an hour east of Winnipeg, I guess a couple miles away from our closest neighbor. We're fairly remote out here. There's 8 of us that live on 80 acres of land where we grow 3/4 of our own food and cut our own firewood on site for the most part. We have clean water that's filtered from a bog close by, so we're able to drink the water from our streams naturally. We're off-grid, and so we use solar power and wind power to supply our electricity needs.
Well, it sounds like, you know, this very, you know, sustainable, you know, very in harmony with nature. This really, I'm sure there's a lot of happiness in your hearts out there in living that way. Tell me, let's start focusing on, see, our group is a cancer prevention group, and we focus on reducing exposure to pollutant carcinogens, and some of the pollution that we educate people about reducing their exposure to is the pollution that is basically the exhaust from the combustion of gasoline or diesel fuel. How does Prairie's Edge minimize the exhaust pollution of driving the car?
Well, because we grow most of our own food out here, we a lot of our time doing that, and we don't need to go shop for stuff or go work away from the farm to earn money. So we don't need to commute very much at all. And when we do, we drive small vehicles and carpool, so we don't have a lot of exhaust pollution from that.
It's great the way, you know, it's great the way your lifestyle itself just leads perfectly into this conserving. You're not really conserving and suffering by way of, you know, doing the conserving of the gasoline and, you know, thereby not burning and not polluting. You're actually living in this way that you are happy to, you know, not be doing this increase, this large, I guess, compared to others, amount, you know, this driving. You're not doing so much driving, and that's really beautiful, you know, way to go about minimizing the exhaust pollution. Can you share with us how the firewood cutting goes? You know, just tell us about, you know, say, days of firewood cutting, you know, and what's like, how you do it, you know, just kind of maybe even, like, if you have any firewood cutting stories or anything, you know, just kind of help people to kind of enjoy, you know, the realities of your firewood cutting lives there on the Prairie's Edge.
Sure. Well, we do most of our logging in the winter when I guess there's not a lot of other stuff to do. And we've built a couple handmade sleds out of downhill skis that we pull down our trails. Our wood lot is a few hundred yards, maybe 500 feet or so away from our home, so it's not terribly far. We've tried a few different methods, from using hand saws to gasoline chainsaws and electric chainsaws for felling the trees. And kind of depends a little bit on whatever system is working the best at that time.
Yep.
But lately we use a gasoline saw to fell the trees. So I burn less than a gallon of gas a year in the chainsaw, so it's not very much chainsaw use. Then once the trees are felled out in the forest there, we pull them back on our sled to either the windmill or the solar panels, where we use an electric chainsaw to cut it up into stove lengths and kind of split it. So we're able to, most of the cutting we do is not with gasoline. So that minimizes emissions quite a bit.
Yep.
Our house design is such that we have built well-insulated straw bale houses that have a lot of south-facing windows. So in my house, for example, I get about two-thirds of my heat actually from the sun directly, and I mostly use the wood for supplementary heat and cooking.
Well, that's really I know some people that have a straw bale house down in the Ithaca area of New York State. It's the Finger Lakes region of New York State. And their wood requirements for heating their house, as you say, they have these south-facing windows and lots of insulation, and it gets nice and warm in there from the sunshine. And they don't need to do a large amount of, you know, wood burning to heat the house either.
Yeah, it's amazing how when you work with nature, then things can be so simple.
Yeah. Tell me, as far as getting back a little to the cutting of the firewood, we would use the chainsaw some, and I was out in Saskatchewan, and I was cutting a lot of firewood. I see I've just gradually become more intense about not breathing the exhaust and not using the chainsaw. I just feel like it's just something that I really don't feel good about doing. And so I did this huge amount of hand firewood cutting, and I was just so fortunate to have come upon this G-Man bow saw, about a 36-inch bow saw. It was called, the manufacturer was G-Man, I think it's a Swedish company. And that saw seemed like it just did not ever get dull. I used to, like, my saws would get dull so quickly in, you know, using other brands of saws and stuff. I was just wondering, do you have any particular hand saws that seem to really do the job finer than any of the rest?
Different people have their different preferences. What I like to use is a carpenter's handsaw I guess carbide tips or hardened tips anyway, so it stays sharp.
Yep.
It's definitely staying sharp is the main key, especially if you're doing stuff by hand.
Right. Yeah, we've even used a two-man.
That's the saw that I like to send.
We've used a two-man crosscut.
Two-man saw.
We used to do that, but it seemed like it was very tiring, and I'm 54 years old. I used to be able to cut firewood, you know, just hour after hour after hour after hour, and split it and, you know, just get it all done. And a lot of it, you know, in one session, so to speak. But that changed, boy, when I get to, I don't know, 50 or so. And so I just have to spread it out a little more and use a real, real, real good saw and all these different things. But I do love being out in the forest. And just, it's so nice and quiet when there's no chainsaw running. And it feels so clean and pristine to be out there, no chemicals, no gas, no oil, just the handsaw and me in the forest. And I spent days after day cutting the black spruce out there in central Saskatchewan to get through the winter. What kind of trees do you guys usually cut for your firewood?
Well, what we have around here is a lot of tamarack.
Oh, yeah?
As well as jack pine, I think.
Yep.
And poplar and ash.
Hmm.
But I think over half of what we burn here is tamarack.
Yeah. Well, that's a little unusual because in all the places that I've lived and, you know, cut firewood, say, like in the Adirondack Mountains or up in Quebec, the James Bay lowlands of Quebec, or out there in Saskatchewan, there's never been any significant amount of tamarack at all. It was the black spruce in the boreal forests and a little aspen, a little, you know, amount of aspen More in some places than others. And out in Saskatchewan, it was mainly spruce and aspen out there. So it's interesting. I'm a little surprised. See, when I drive across Canada, I start, seeing prairie. So you guys must be, as the name of your village indicates, just kind of where there's still some forest left right on the edge of the prairie.
We're right on the edge of the Canadian Shield. So our water that flows into the property is from the rocky forested area to the east of us. And
oh, yeah.
And we're just on the eastern edge of the prairies.
So is it
in the summer we...
Go ahead.
In the summer we do most of our gardening and whatnot out in the prairies. But in the winter, it's way too windy and fiercely cold out there. For the most part, we do our logging and stuff in the forest. And like you said, it's just beautiful out in the forest. It's not windy out there, and it's just crisp and still.
So then your land, so your land actually has some prairie and some forest. That's just so cool, The way you're just right there on that boundary, that line, where these different ecosystems come together. It must be a really awesome place, Who had the great role of choosing that place to be an eco-village?
Well, for about a year before we bought land, we were living in the city and we had a group there that would meet every week, and there was maybe between about 15 people that came to those meetings. We were kind of looking for land. We'd go on little road trips and look for land sometimes. So there was a group of us that came out here, and when we saw it advertised in the paper, and we were sold. But I guess when we found the land, then it wasn't everybody's ideal land. Some people wanted to live on a lake, and some people wanted to be closer or further from the city. So there was five of us that ended up moving out here that spring.
Well, it must be really cool to, just be a part of that kind of coming together and, evolving and, moving forward with your ideas and, how you want to live, and then just kind of do it and see how it turns out. And it sounds like you've got something really special going there. Tell me, why do you live? Why did you start looking for that land? Why did you want to come together with those groups of people? Why did you create this Prairie's Edge eco-village to live in?
Excuse me. I guess the lifestyle really appeals to me. I like the simplicity involved in creating one's own food and shelter. I also like the freedom of being able to, there's a lot of space around here for us to do and create what we want. So we have to worry a bit less about building codes than we would in the city, for example. So we're allowed to be more creative with our building design, more progressive. So I guess a lot of the freedom and the simplicity involved in the lifestyle that we've created out here is what I really like.
Were there any, say, particular books or leaders, people that you consider to have lived this way, prior to your beginning to this way? Was there any, kind of leadership you were following, or was this just, had you lived this way before? Where did that get started?
I'm not sure exactly where it got started. For a few years when I was quite young, I lived in Kentucky on a small intentional community. So it could have been a seed planted there.
Yep.
But for most of my childhood, I grew up urban. I definitely did a lot of reading before we moved out here, going to libraries and finding anything I could that seemed relevant. There was a lot of stuff done in the 70s and early 80s with energy efficient design, a lot of solar stuff happening. A lot of stuff happening back then. There were some really good books on. Also, the Encyclopedia of Country Living by Carla Emery is an amazing resource for us out here, not having a lot of experience with what we needed, the skills we needed to grow our own food and such. So we looked at that book a couple times a day for a few years. Definitely. And there's another community about an hour and a half away from us here that have been doing somewhat similar things for 15 or 20 years before us. They've been quite a help quite often for skills and inspiration.
So what's the name of that village?
That's the Northern Sun Farm Co-op.
The Northern Sun Farm Co-op.
We just celebrated their, yes, yeah, we just celebrated, I think, their 25th anniversary as a co-op.
Well, that's cool.
This last summer.
So let's kind of get a little more philosophical here. How can people change, Daniel? How can people change in their hearts and come to love the earth more? You know, it seems to me that loving the earth is a very central in what we have been talking about. And I feel like that if everyone was living like you are living, and the people in the eco-village are living, certainly there will be less pollution and less disease caused by pollution, less destruction of habitat, and, you know, just everything will be going in a far better direction than it is right at the moment. And I'm hopeful about those changes taking place. So, you know, can you share with us any of your ideas on how people change in their hearts and come to love the earth? You've certainly had some experience of that in your own life. Maybe it was, you know, getting started young with the intentional communities, and did you guys do gardening and raise food and all that kind of thing when you were on that village in that community in Kentucky?
Yeah, there was a lot of food growing and chickens and goats and such. And I think that's a huge part of it, like just spending time being involved with the earth and the seasons and experiencing it, the earth providing for our needs is an amazing connection. And I think that just being involved in that process kind of helps to create that connection and that love for living. So it seems to be learning to enjoy it by doing it.
Yep.
Is the strongest connection that I see.
For me, I did a lot of the growing food, you know, for my own, you know, consumption. I did these huge gardens, and for a long time, I was producing all the vegetables and fruit that I more than what I ate, and then also pretty close to the amount of grain too. We did a lot of field corn and ground the corn, and I did some oats at one time too, but that wasn't nearly as kind of effective as doing the field corn, the ear corn, and having that hard dry corn to grind and make corn cereal from. But you know, for you, just to kind of get a little, you know, just kind of more personal understanding of what your life is like, is it more joyous to your heart, say, to be out cutting firewood in the forest, or to be gardening, or getting water from the land, or what's your, you know, what causes your heart to be the most joyous about your connection to nature?
It's hard to pick out one from the other. It's kind of like a big picture kind of thing. But maybe if I were to pick one, like one of my favorite times of year is harvesting squash in the fall once the frost has come, and going and hunting for all the squash underneath the vines is a lot like Christmas kind of for me. Maybe that's the of the parts that I enjoy the most, but I think it's the whole picture of being totally provided for out here and having it all come together really simply.
So tell me this, what are the main plants, you know, what are the main foods that you produce there on the, you know, the plains there at Prairie's Edge? What is the main food that you guys kind of produce?
Well, we grow a lot of squash.
Yep.
It seems to be by far the easiest to plant and grow and harvest and store and use. It's just really the most bang for our buck we find.
Yep.
Also, we grow a lot of root crops that we store in our root cellar over the winter, like potatoes, beets, carrots, parsnips, onions. And we also grow a lot of tomatoes and peppers. And we do a bunch of other stuff too, but those would be the ones that have a significant contribution to our diet.
Yep. Do you grow any of the grains? You know, have any kind of like grain type crops?
Not really. Like we've tried corn before, but our soil up here is so heavy and doesn't warm up very.
I see. Yep.
Very quick. So we really have trouble getting it finished in our season, and also all the other animals just love it so much that.
Yep.
The raccoons don't wait for it to get ripe so we can harvest it. So. We haven't done that so much. We tend to buy most of our grains in bulk. We also grow beans, do some of our own pulse crops. But it's quite daunting the amount of work one would have to do to grow their own grains. I'm quite impressed that you're doing that. That's amazing.
Well, see, we had it kind of easy. We didn't. That was the only work we did. You know, we just did that. We had been farmers, you know, to a limited degree. My father is a veterinarian, and he worked for the federal government. And so, you know, he would come home and, you know, from work, and then, you know, have the money that it took to run the farm, and then we would just do this. We raised some cattle and had registered Holsteins and did some of that. But truly, after a while, we just kind of got tired of the animal end of it. And just spend more and more time just doing these huge gardens and these cornfields. And it was that, you know, we weren't having to support ourselves, you know, as far as the other parts of life, like the shelter and the clothing and the, you know, the gasoline and the medicine and whatever else you got to buy. Just, we had a huge amount of time just to really enjoy producing this food, you know. It was kind of a family project. My father helped a lot, but toward the end it was mainly just my brother and I. And I did a lot alone too, you know. I loved being out there on the land, just alone, just doing all the good earth-type stuff. So tell me, we're talking about kind of changing our hearts and loving the earth. The United Nations General Assembly, they did this resolution in late 2009. I think it was December 30th or thereabouts in 2009, where they've called, this call has gone out from the UN, for all the peoples of the earth to share their knowledge and experience of living in harmony with the earth, because they, you know, they are, you know, making this point that living in harmony is a step, you know, a means of reaching sustainability. So do you think that, you know, can you give us any advice? Can you share? What you've been sharing truly all along here is this very essence of that. But do you want to add anything to it? You know, is there... If you were going to be addressing, say you were going to send out some, you know, a statement or speak before the UN or provide them this input, however they, you know, make it possible to receive input, is there anything in particular that you would want to say to the people of the world about living in harmony and achieving sustainability in that manner?
Well, that's a big one.
I know it.
I think it's really valuable and worthwhile to do. Like in our society now, we collectively kind of seem to value progress and jobs and kind of getting ahead in that way. but I didn't know about this UN proclamation, and I think it's right on. It seems to kind of hit the nail on the head that it's that's really what's valuable and important, and if our society valued that more, then we would go in that direction a lot more. So I think that would be a huge step forward if a kind of social values kind of change to value that more. In schools, we learn about the careers we can have. We don't learn about ways that we can lead a simple life. So that would be a big change to get anywhere closer to that.
Yeah, I feel like that if people got their joy from, say, the simple life that you're describing and this sense of being in love with and close to the earth and the rest of nature, if they just changed their minds about, you know, what they preferred, whether it's that or having a career and making lots of money and buying a lot of stuff, it would be a huge change in everything. Nothing will be the same. It would all be better, you know, as far as I can, you know, sense and think. So I think there is good movement in a direction that can lead us to a higher place, you know, in our humanity. I have one more question for you. And it's just this other side of things, so to speak. You know, we're talking about living in harmony and having, you know, joy in our life and, you know, a sustainable society and a healthy earth. But at the same time that we're thinking and talking these things, there are other parts of the human race, you know, other parts of society, such as those corporations that are intent upon exploiting the tar sands in Western Canada, in Alberta, and then possibly moving over into Saskatchewan as well, you know, in the near future. And there's the pipelines building and the refining these tar sands in the Great Lakes Basin, both in Canada and in the U.S. states. And so what I'm thinking is, you know, if that's going on right at the same time what we're doing, you know, what you and I and others that want to be in harmony are doing, it seems like there's this potential for, you know, maybe our good, you know, effects being overcome and you know, basically ruined and wrecked by the adverse effects that are created by these very, very large activities that are exploitive and, you know, non-sustainable and non-harmonious. You know, do you have any ideas? Because I'm trying to figure it out. How do we stop these abusive practices that, you know, are so big and so damaging?
Well, it'd be hard for any one of us to stop